From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the romantic and squalid appeal of French writer Jean Genet. We talk with novelist Edmund White about his new biography of Genet, one of the great and controversial 20th century writers. Genet constructed a legend of himself as a golden thug and sexual outlaw, something that fascinated White when he was a young gay man from the middle class. Also, we meet one of the pioneers of pop art, Roy Lichtenstein. He used to find inspiration in comic books and advertisements. Now he finds it in the Yellow Pages. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Last Splash, the new album by The Breeders. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate voted today to demand life sentences for criminals who have three convictions for violent felonies. The measure was approved as an amendment to the anti-crime package on a vote of 91-1. Supporters say the measure is aimed at the 6% of criminals who commit 70% of violent crimes in the United States, but it would apply only to those who have three felony convictions in federal court. The measure is similar to one approved by voters in Washington State in a referendum last week. The amendment was attached to a crime bill that already authorizes more than $22 billion for more police and prisons. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has approved the final draft of a new constitution that will be put to the voters in a referendum in December. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Russian political leaders began work on this current constitutional draft last June, but the work took on added urgency after the uprising at the parliament in October, when Yeltsin decreed a constitutional referendum for December 12th, the same day the voters will choose a new parliament. All the details in the current draft are not yet known, but the draft does give the Russian president considerable powers, including the power under certain circumstances to dissolve the new parliament. One of the thorniest problems is how political power will be decentralized among Russia's 89 regions. 21 are so-called autonomous ethnic republics, which have demanded the new constitution recognize their sovereignty as independent states. It is believed this final draft has eliminated any such reference to their sovereignty, and that could raise doubts about whether those regions will be willing to support the draft. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Jack Kevorkian has been freed from a Detroit jail after a local lawyer posted a $2,000 cash bond. The doctor has also ended his three-day-old hunger strike. Don Gagne reports.
Kevorkian is charged under a new Michigan law which makes assisting in a suicide a felony. Since that law went into effect, he has been present at three suicides. He was jailed last Friday after he refused to post a cash bond in one of the two criminal cases pending against him. Further, the doctor vowed to starve himself to death to protest the law. But today, after 3 days in which he consumed only water, fruit juices, and vitamins, the 65-year-old Kevorkian accepted the largesse of a suburban Detroit attorney who put up the money needed to get the doctor out. Kevorkian appeared to be healthy as he left the jail just before noon. Next week, a Detroit judge is scheduled to hear arguments relating to the constitutionality of Michigan's assisted suicide ban. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,648. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up 3.2 at 766.2. This is NPR News. The number two official at the State Department is reported to be resigning. Wire Services quoted sources in the administration and Congress as saying that Clifton Wharton Jr. has submitted his resignation and that it's been accepted. Wharton has served only 8 months as second-in-command to Secretary of State Warren Christopher. A Somali employee of the relief agency CARE has been killed in an incident involving UN troops from Malaysia. According to CARE officials, the agency's head of security in the Somali capital was killed after Malaysian troops responded to one round of fire that came from an unidentified gunman in a building near the CARE compound. CARE said that it's lodged a complaint with UN officials in Somalia. The BBC's Roger Hearing reports from Mogadishu.
The United Nations still says the situation in the city is calm. But in the latest incident, witnesses say a Malaysian military convoy was fired on near the offices of the aid agency, CARE. Malaysians fired back, and during the shooting, chief of security at CAIR was killed, and another guard was injured. Agency officials say their casualties were caused by Malaysian bullets, and neither man had been involved in the incident. The UN Deputy Force spokesman, Captain Tim McDavitt, said he had no knowledge of casualties from the shooting. There have been what the UN describes as random shootings over the past 4 days in the city. There have been no casualties on the UN side, and UN officials are careful not to imply that these incidents constitute a break in the ceasefire announced by General Aidid and his faction, the Somali National Alliance, 4 weeks ago.
Roger Hearing in Mogadishu. A new study finds that children's TV shows are larded with commercials for high-fat junk foods. The study found that the number of TV food ads aimed at children has doubled recently, growing to about 40% of the ads inserted in children's programming. The study found that an even bigger portion of those ads are now showing images of fatty foods such as hamburger, pizza, and fried chicken. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edmund White, is best known for his autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story and The Beautiful Room is Empty, chronicling the adolescence and coming of age of a gay man. Now White has written a biography of a writer who greatly influenced him, Jean Genet. Genet is considered one of France's most original writers of the 20th century. The Genet legend, which he constructed with his writings, is of a thief, vagabond, and sexual outlaw. In the autobiography, Genet, Ed White tries to find the true story of the real man. Genet lived from 1910 to 1986. He wrote 5 novels, including Our Lady of the Flowers, a volume of memoirs called Prisoner of Love, and several plays, including The Maids and The Balcony. Ed White never met Genet, but White's life was changed by Genet's writing.
First of all, it seemed to me swooningly beautiful. I mean, I think that he was somebody, for instance, I mean, I was a nice little middle-class boy, and I think had I not read Genet, I would have been alarmed by drag queens, sneered at them the way most middle-class gay guys did in those days. But because of Genet, I found something heartbreakingly beautiful and romantic about this whole sort of gay underworld, the world of hustlers, of drag queens, of petty thieves, and so on. So when I arrived in New York in 1962, I used to love to walk up and down Greenwich Avenue and see the people that middle-class gays dismissed as riffraff.
Did you seek out some of the squalor that Genet wrote about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I even tried to be in male pornography for a while. I mean, it was all ridiculously misfired. And I have a book of essays coming out next year. And one of the essays is one that I wrote at the time, which was never published in the 60s, called On Becoming a Model for Male Slut. I'm Becoming a Model for Male Smut or something like that. And none of it worked. All of my attempts join the underworld were horribly misfired. But anyway, I did find something very romantic and beautiful about it.
You know, I think one explanation about why your attempts to join the underworld misfired, I mean, if you look at 2 of your major literary influences, you have Genet influencing on you on one hand and Nabokov on the other.
That's true, right. But, I mean, what they have in common is they're both dandies. I mean, they're both people who don't think of human society in collective terms, who see themselves as isolated individuals living outside the herd. And that very much rang a bell for me in those days, in the 60s, when my own sensibility was being formed. I think now, I mean, I have a much more of a collective sense of being a gay man amongst other gay people. But in those days, I felt very isolated, and I liked that aspect of their work.
Your biography of Genet opens in the outhouse, and I'd like you to read the beginning of chapter 1.
Thank you. Somebody said the other day in Vogue magazine that this must be the strangest beginning of any big book. As a child in the village of Aligny-en-Morvan, southwest of Dijon, Genet liked to spend hours in the outhouse. There were 2 outhouses, one close to the big stone house with the slate roof, the other 20 paces across the vegetable garden and next to the school wall. It was in this less convenient, more remote cell that he passed hours daydreaming and reading. And this is a quote from one of his books. The memory with the quickest sting is of the toilet outside the house with the slate floor. It was my refuge, life, which I perceived as distant and blurred through its shadow and smell, a softening smell in which the odor of elder trees and the rich earth predominated, since the outhouse was all the way at the end of the garden near the hedge. Life reached me as singularly sweet, tender, light, or rather lightened, stripped of its heaviness. I speak of this life which consisted of the things outside the toilet, the remainder of the world, everything that wasn't my little hideout of boards riddled by insects. Life seemed to me to float a bit like a painted dream, while I, in my hole, like a larva, took up a peaceful, nocturnal existence. And sometimes I had the feeling I was slowly sinking deeper, as in a sleep, or a lake, or a maternal bosom, or even an act of incest toward the spiritual center of the world.
Why did you begin there, in the outhouse?
Because I feel that Genet was somebody who was essentially and deeply solitary. Solitary to the point that he was always surrounded by a kind of invisible shell that protected him from contact with other people. And I wanted to show that there was this theme in his life that when he was a boy, he was in the outhouse listening to the world, observing it, but not seeing it, but hearing it, imagining it, thinking of it. But in this totally solitary space of his own. Later, he was in prison and again tried to imagine the life and loves of purely fictive characters that he invented. And he wrote his first two novels in prison and the other three in the shadow of prison, in the sense that he was always afraid of being arrested again and given life imprisonment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edmund White, and he's written a new biography of Jean Genet. Genet never knew his father. His mother abandoned him when he was a child, so he became a ward of the state in France. He went to reform school and then later to prison. What were the crimes he was charged with committing, and what were his sentences?
Genet liked to darkly hint that he was a real big-time criminal, and he even said to an interviewer who interviewed him late in life, you can ask me anything you want, but don't ask me if I ever murdered someone. But in fact, when we plumbed into the realities of Genet's criminal record, we found he'd stolen four bottles of aperitif, he'd stolen a fabric sample, he'd stolen a luxury edition of Verlaine's poems, Fête Galante, he'd stolen the autographs of two French kings, he had stolen another book, he had doctored his train ticket, and he'd stolen fabric samples twice. I have just listed his entire crimes.
Right, so he's not among the world's most hardened criminals.
Cocteau, who discovered Genet and first got him published in the 1940s, said, "Look, you're a very great writer and a terrible thief. Please, please stop stealing."
His writing about prison has a certain erotic power. I mean, in his fiction, he found an erotic power in prison. What about his real-life experience of prison?
I think his real life experience of prison was pretty miserable, but I think that the secret about Genet is that the one emotion he never wanted to solicit from the reader was pity. I think he was terrified of appearing pitiful in anyone's eyes. He was very proud, and I start my book actually with a quotation from Kierkegaard, in which he says that there's this kind of person who's passed so far away from God into sin that even if God were to now appear before him and forgive him for all his sins, he wouldn't want to be forgiven. He wants to rage against the whole world, because only by doing so can he prove to himself that he's in the right. And I think that's really crucial to Genet. So Genet pictures, I mean, if you look at, for instance, there's a whole tradition of prison poetry in France, but the other prison poets are all people who are saying, "Oh, I am sad, you are happy because you're outside the prison. I didn't really commit the crime. Please release me. I want to join you. I see a little dog walking by on the street outside the prison bars. Why can't I be?" Genet is entirely the opposite of this. He says, "Look, you're a jerk, you reader, and you're leading this boring middle-class life, and we guys in prison are all having fabulous sex and this very rich, hierarchical, marvelous existence that is like something out of the Middle Ages."
How interested were you in finding out about Genet's real sex life and how that compared to the sexuality of his fictional characters?
Well, I was interested in every way trying to figure out what was the difference between Genet's legend as he presented it and what was the truth. And that was certainly one aspect of it, because I was able to interview for hours and hours and hours, days and days, one of his lovers named Java, who appears as a character in Thief's Journal, and who is a very frank and open guy, and who told me that most of Genet's sexuality was in his head, that he didn't like really having sex very often. He loved to write about it. Once in a while, he would go out when they were living in a little hotel room together in Montmartre and hire a hustler. But it was all sort of quickly done. He didn't really like sex that much, but he loved to talk about it.
How did Genet get interested in literature? Because the life that you're describing is so much the life of somebody who you'd think would be cut off from the world of literature.
Well, I think that when he was a boy, he was the number one student in the village. He was the person that was the leading student in the whole county, and was considered very brilliant, was constantly reading, and who was the priest's favorite choir boy, because he spoke Latin with the best accent and memorized the verses best. So he's not at all the sort of tough little criminal child that he liked to picture later. He was, in fact, a sissy. And like a classic gay boy sissy, he was somebody who didn't want to work, didn't like to play with boys, but rather he liked to play with dolls, with girls, and who liked to dress up, was interested in the mass, in ceremonies in general, and was a tremendous daydreamer who didn't have very many friends, and who liked to go off into the fields with a cow, and while the cow grazed, he sat and read books. Later, when he was sent to reform school, he wasn't allowed to study because Maitre had a very sinister injunction against teaching the boys anything that might give them ideas above their station. But somehow or other, Genet got his hands on the poems by the Renaissance French poet Ronsard and memorized them, as he would later do in prison with the plays of Racine. So that Genet was somebody who very freely in conversation could introduce whole stanzas of poetry from the great classics. Then he was 6 years in the army, and that's a period in his life that he always concealed because he didn't like to admit that he'd done something so normal as be a soldier. But while he was in the army, he was stationed in a very boring French town called Toul, and there he read all of Dostoevsky and a lot of contemporary fiction, and even began a literary correspondence with other writers.
You write how in the later part of Genet's life he took up the cause of the Black Panthers in the United States, of the PLO, but gay rights was never high on his list of causes. Do you know why not?
Well, I think that he didn't rank it as being so important. I mean, I think, in other words, he... first of all, I think he's somebody who, when he was queried by the gay German writer Hubert Fichte in the 1970s, Fichte said, "Do you mean to say when you were a young guy, you were a hustler and you used to beat up other gay people? Didn't you have any feeling of solidarity toward other gays?" And Genet said, "Not at all." And he says, "And you're being absurd if you expect me, as a peasant boy in the 1930s in France, if you expect me then to have had the kind of sophisticated political consciousness that you have now in the 1970s in Germany." So I think he's quite right. I mean, he is showing us that before gay liberation, people didn't have much of a feeling of solidarity with other gays. And Genet never experienced his sexuality as a collective thing, as I mentioned earlier. He always felt that it was something unique and personal and solitary.
Ed White is my guest. He's written a new biography of Jean Genet. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Ed White is my guest. In a New York Times Magazine article that you wrote a few years ago on gay fiction, you said perhaps no other body of literature is as subject to political pressure from within the community as gay fiction is. Does that relate to Genet at all? Has he been seen as not being good for gay writers, or as very important, as a very important part of gay fiction? Yeah, in other words, have there been kind of political reasons to like or not like Genet?
I don't think he's had much of an influence on American gay theorists. I think that most of the important gay theorists have taken a longer look at Proust, let's say, than at Genet. But maybe, I like to think, my book might get people talking about it and thinking about it. I think Genet has a lot to teach people about sexuality.
Getting back to your comment about pressure from within the gay community on people who write gay fiction, did you feel subjected to any of that pressure, either in deciding to write a biography on Genet or in your interpretation of him?
Well, it's interesting. While I was working on it, Larry Kramer gave an interview to The Advocate in which he said that the only acceptable thing for any gay writer in the world to be doing now was to write about AIDS. And he said Edmund White, of all things, is writing about Genet. But the other day I talked to Larry and he said, oh, well, now I've read your book and I think it was worth your while. I'm glad you did it. So I thought that was very nice of him. I wasn't disturbed that he said it anyway. I mean, it just seemed to me that we can't all do the same thing, and there are AIDS activists and who are writing about that. I wanted to write about Genet because as somebody who's HIV positive himself, I like to be reminded that there are other aspects of gay culture that have nothing to do with illness. It seems to me that before 1969, homosexuality was pretty much treated as a medical problem. And one of the great triumphs of gay liberation was to demedicalize it. And now, because of AIDS, once again, every time the public thinks about gays, they think about AIDS, that is a medical problem. So, for instance, in the midst of all of the sadness of losing friends and lovers, I found reading Richard Ellman's biography of Oscar Wilde a wonderful inspiration, because here was a reminder of this towering figure who was this great cultural figure who was martyred, but for other political reasons, not for medical reasons. And I think that Genet is a similar figure. And I think that it's interesting to have these sort of beacons shining through what is a darker and darker night.
Well, you mentioned the dark night. I mean, that reminds me that your editor who asked you to write this biography, Bill Whitehead, died after you agreed to write the book. Your mother died while you wrote the book. Was it hard to write the book with that happening around you?
And I mean, the book is dedicated to Hubert Sorin, who's my French lover who has AIDS and who's in a bad way, and to Bill Whitehead, who, after he commissioned it, did die. And, I think that I part of my feeling was, well, why am I spending so much time on a biography that, after all, could be written by somebody else, whereas only I can write my fiction, whether it's good or bad. But on the other hand, I thought, I don't know, this is an interesting piece of work. I think I'm the right person to do it. I think it should be done now, because most of the people who knew Genet, especially those who knew him when he was young, are dying, and have many of them since died after I interviewed them. So it seemed to me very important to get all this down before it vanished.
Was it good for you to write something that wasn't coming just solely from within, you know?
Yeah, I found it an enormous relief, frankly, to not think about myself for a while.
Uh-huh.
I found it, and it's interesting, like, I'm not all that well known as a novelist in France, and so people just would leave me alone and let me do my work. But every once in a while I would go to England to give a reading and to talk about Genet, and people would suddenly say, but what about your own fiction? It would startle me, because I sort of forgotten about my own fiction. I was so absorbed in this project while working on it, so afraid I wouldn't finish it, so afraid, I mean, that I would get AIDS dementia and lose my memory, which, of course, is a nightmare for anybody, but especially for a biographer. I mean, I had so much information in my head, and I kept thinking, am I going to get it all down before I enter into some sort of mental decline? Anyway, it all got done, and I'm still in perfectly good health, even after 10 years of being positive.
That's really good to hear. That's very good to hear.
Thanks.
I want to get back to the process of writing the biography of Genet. One thing that you said someplace that really interested me is that it was much more difficult to interview people in France than it is to interview people in the United States. That you couldn't just pick up the phone and casually ask people intimate questions like you actually can do in the United States.
Absolutely. There's an entirely different attitude toward information, toward meeting people, and so on. In France, it's sort of like Japan. You have to always have an intermediary call for you and prepare the groundwork for you. And then later you call that person. And you have to sort of lay siege to somebody. The most extreme case of that was I wanted to interview a woman called Paul Thévenin. She was a good friend of Genet's during the 60s and helped him prepare the final script of the screens and was a very important witness for me. But she refused point-blank to see me. So in my totally Machiavellian and creepy way, I hired an American girl for a year to pretend to take French lessons from this woman so that she could become friendly enough that she could then later introduce me to Paul. And then Paul and I became great friends, and I think she finally developed a lot of confidence in me and knew I was going to do a serious book, and she lived long enough to read it and to like it. But it's very, very hard to get French people to open up. And also with a subject like Genet, I mean, if you think of the usual literary biography is about a writer who was middle class, who grew up much photographed by his parents. Every little theme paper that he did in school was saved by his mother. All of his friends later turned out to be lawyers and doctors and have abundant memories of him and long lives in which to bear witness. Whereas Genet is not at all that kind of life, because the first half of his life is passed amongst the kind of people who are very hard to find. I mean, in other words, vagabonds, jailbirds, male prostitutes. I mean, this is a group of people who, alas, oftentimes die young or are hard to find mm-hmm. or melt away. If you do find them, they don't want to tell you anything. If they do tell you something, you're not sure you can believe it. I mean, it was very, very difficult to track all this stuff down.
You've written a series of two autobiographical novels, and they take you up to the period where you're a young man. Are you continuing this series? And if so, where are you in it?
Right. I wrote first A Boy's Own Story, which was about my adolescence, then The Beautiful Room Is Empty, which was about my 20s, and that ended with the Stonewall Uprising in 1969, the beginning of gay liberation. Now I'm continuing it with a book called The Farewell Symphony, which is about the 70s and the 80s, that is, the decade before and the decade after AIDS. And the title comes from the name of a Haydn symphony in which all the instrumentalists get up and leave the stage one after another, and there's only one violin left playing at the end, which is very much the feeling I have, having lost 50 or 60 of my closest friends, that is my whole generation in New York. For instance, I used to belong to a writer's club called the Violet Quill, and of the 8 original members, there are only 3 of us still living.
So does that mean you feel a certain responsibility to tell a story?
Yes, and a peculiar freedom. It's like nobody can contradict me because nobody's left alive. Yes, it is. I do feel a responsibility to talk. I mean, it's funny because now at age 53, I feel almost archaeological sometimes in my memories, because if I'll talk about the kind of wild times of the 70s, it seems very puzzling to young people today, who just feel it's almost mythical.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Edmund White is the author of the new book, Genet, A Biography. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the anti-art of painter Roy Lichtenstein. In the 1960s, he went against everything he'd learned to become one of the instigators of pop art. Using bright colors outlined by black lines and filled in with dots, he painted works inspired by comic books and advertisements. A retrospective of Lichtenstein's work is at the Guggenheim. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by The Breeders. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has spent the day behind closed doors lobbying for approval of the North American Free Trade Agreement. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
With the vote on the trade pact only 9 days away, the White House says the full court press is on. The president is still dozens of votes away from the 218 he needs to win in the House of Representatives. Today, Mr. Clinton had a series of meetings with undecided Democrats, two or three at a time. He and Vice President Al Gore will have dinner with about 20 more tonight. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen bravely predicted that the White House would win, but no new lawmakers came out to say they'd vote yes. One, Montana Democratic Representative Pat Williams, announced he'd vote no. He said the pact was bad for Montana's agriculture. Lawmakers who met with the president today said he stressed how important the agreement was to the national interest and to his presidency. Tomorrow, the debate over NAFTA goes public again when Vice President Al Gore faces off against Ross Perot on the Larry King Live show. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Moscow, Russian leader Boris Yeltsin has given his approval to a new state charter that helps him in consolidating power. Voters will cast their ballots on the measure next month. Under the plan, Yeltsin would serve a full 5-year term instead of holding an early presidential election in June. A spokesman said that Yeltsin signed the draft after making a few amendments. One aide is quoted as saying the only major change calls for making people citizens of the Russian Federation only and doing away with regional citizenship. Abortion rights activists to file suit to block the enforcement of state constitutional provisions in Arkansas and Colorado involving government payment for poor women's abortions. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Last month, President Clinton signed into law an appropriations bill that provides abortion coverage for poor women in cases where the mother's life is in danger and in cases of rape and incest. That marked an expansion of the previous federal law, which only provided for Medicaid coverage in life-threatening cases. Now, lawyers for the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy have gone to court, asserting that the new federal law automatically invalidates laws in two states, Arkansas and Colorado. In recent years, both states amended their constitutions to bar the use of taxpayer funds for abortions for poor women, except in cases where the life of the mother is threatened. Now the pro-choice lawyers are asking that the laws be enjoined because they contradict the new federal law. If the suit is successful, Arkansas and Colorado would have to pay for Medicaid abortions not just when the life of the mother is threatened, but also in cases of rape and incest. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 4 points to close at 3,647.90 on volume of 234 million shares. This is NPR News. In Somalia, UN peacekeepers have come under fire for the fourth day in a row. In one attack, a Somalian security man for CARE was killed and another guard was wounded. A U.S. military spokesman accused fugitive factional leader General Adid of not cooperating and said that the U.S. intends to put its forces back on the streets of the capital. Adid's forces have boycotted two U.N.-sponsored meetings on working out a peace agreement. Adid has warned of more trouble if U.S. troops are put back on the streets of the capital, having turned over command of the U.N. peacekeeping mission to the U.N. in May. Administration sources say that the number two man at the State Department, Deputy Secretary of State Clifton Wharton Jr., has resigned. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The surprise resignation of Clifton Wharton Jr. comes only 8 months after he took the job as Deputy Secretary of State. During his brief tenure, Wharton had concentrated on proposals to reorganize the Agency for International Development, as well as redirect U.S. foreign aid programs. A former chancellor of the State University of New York and president of Michigan State University, Wharton left his job as head of the multi-billion-dollar Teachers Pension Fund to join the Clinton administration. The son of the first black career diplomat to be named U.S. ambassador, Wharton was well regarded in Washington. The announcement of his resignation followed speculation this weekend over his future. Earlier today, State Department spokesman Mike McCurry declined to comment on official discussions, saying only that Wharton's job was being reassessed. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Members of the European community have agreed to look at a new peace plan for Bosnia that includes a promise to lift UN sanctions if Bosnian factions are given more territory. The plan, supported by both France and Germany, also calls for aid routes under the protection of UN troops. Officials have defended the plan as a way to get peace talks moving again. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Roy Lichtenstein put wham and blam into his paintings, literally. His early paintings from the 60s were inspired by comic books. In fact, they look just like frames from romance comics, war comics, and Mickey Mouse comics, including the thought balloons and the Sacco Pow exclamations. Lichtenstein still uses the visual language of comics, bright colors outlined in black, often filled in with colored dots. But his subject matter has recently shifted to interiors and to advertising images from the pages of the phone book. Lichtenstein is one of the founders of pop art. He brought the subject matter and style of popular culture into the fine arts. The Guggenheim Museum has mounted a major retrospective of his work, which runs through January 16th. I asked Lichtenstein why he first wanted to do his own versions of romance comics and war comics.
I guess what I liked about both of them is that they're both emotional in different ways. I mean, the war things are full of action, and the women are crying,
right. You
know, or waiting for telephone calls or something. And that is the stereotype portrayed in comic books at the time, which really reflected the feeling of society. And that, but the idea of doing highly emotional subject matter in a very dry, mechanical, removed way seemed to symbolize something about where society was. I mean, wars were being waged at a push of the button and things like that.
In one of your love comics, a worried woman is asking the man who is with her, it's not an engagement ring, is it? And in the catalog that accompanies your show at the Guggenheim, they reprint the comic that you base that on. It's from a Winnie Winkle comic.
Mm-hmm.
And the context that comes from, the woman is saying, Perry, about this piece of jewelry you're planning to buy for Tanya. And he says, I just want to show her how much she means to me. And then the woman says, It's not an engagement ring, is it?
I know. It's a completely different thing when it's taken out of context.
Yeah. So, what interested you in that particular Winnie Winkle?
Well, it wasn't the Winnie Winkle. It was just a pretty girl and a handsome man
mm-hmm.
and those stereotypes. And the cliche of being enthralled about engagement rings. I mean, I'm sure everyone is even now, but it seemed like a male and a female thing to do.
Now, did you ever hear from the original artists who did the strips that you...
Well, I've really only heard from William Overgaard, and he wrote me a nice letter saying he was so pleased to see his work in the Guggenheim Museum. he did Steve Roper, and he's said several things which are quite cogent about pop artists and cartoonists and things like that. But he's really, I think, the only one I've heard from. Nobody's ever said, you stole my cartoon or something like that.
Another love comic that ends up, or love comic type image that ends up really being about the art world, is a woman is saying to the man, "Why, Bart, darling, this painting is a masterpiece. My, soon you'll have all of New York clamoring for your work." did that come from something, or did you just make that one up?
No, it came from almost all the lines come from. I can't make up lines like that. I think that was a line connected to that particular cartoon. I may have edited it a little bit. Sometimes they take lines from other cartoons or put two together or edit it in some way. You know, I want it to sound either more general or more confused or whatever strikes me, you know, about what I liked about the line. And, of course, then when I did it, it was... It didn't seem as though all of New York was going to be clamoring for my work, but
little did you know. All of your paintings, or maybe I should say most of your paintings, come from print matter, from a two-dimensional source, from comics or from advertisements, or in some cases from other paintings. You seldom, if ever, paint from life itself. Why is that? I mean, you know, there's the tradition in art that you're painting from the still life or the model or the landscape. You're painting from life, not from a reproduction of life.
Yeah. Well, I know that. I even did that before. I mean, when I was in the 50s, I had several shows in New York, which not many people know about. And the work was kind of expressionist and cubist and, you know, very derivative in retrospect. And it was from historical paintings or paintings of cowboys and Indians or something like that. So I always seem to have used two-dimensional sources. And, you know, I mean, I feel that artists are always using two-dimensional sources. They just think they're using three-dimensional sources. In other words, if we all started to learn to draw and paint simply by looking at the model, we'd all be painting like children. You know, it really is that you're painting in terms of the history of art, and you're really making a drawing of a life model the way Michelangelo did. You know, I don't mean that there have been no advances in this, but mostly all of that seeing is learned from looking at two-dimensional sources, not three-dimensional sources. That's not really the reason I do it, but...
The real reason is...
The real reason is I have no idea.
Right, okay.
Like the real reason for everything.
I'll buy that.
Yeah.
You did a series of paintings of brushstrokes, and of course, in abstract expressionism, you know, brushstrokes were brushstrokes and dripping paint were about what it was all about. I mean, it was about seeing the action, the process of the painting, the hand of the painter, the drip of the paint.
Yeah.
But of course, the brushstrokes that you painted had no real dripping paint at all. I mean, the drips were carefully colored in. was this your comment on abstract expressionism, this kind of ironic version of brushstrokes?
No, I think it was a comment on the comparison between that bravura act that they did with paint and the my way of representing it, which is it's where I'm painstakingly drawing the brushstroke up, you know, as though I were painting something difficult to paint, you know, and that one is romantic and the other is classical, and that it's really a drawing of an ideal brushstroke or something that looks like a brushstroke. And it doesn't fool you. I mean, you don't think it's real, that it's really a brushstroke, but you think it's a picture of a brushstroke, and, you know, that's a kind of absurd thing to do. And it has that built-in absurdity, and that's the reason I like it.
My guest is artist Roy Lichtenstein. There's a retrospective of his work at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Artist Roy Lichtenstein is my guest. There's a chapter in the catalog that accompanies your Guggenheim show, a chapter that's called Clichés into Icons. Mm-hmm. Is that what you see yourself as doing, transforming clichés into icons?
Well, I like the idea, and I do think that there's a relationship between classical art and cliché. I mean, the Greeks or Romans, we look at as trying to make ideal figures or ideals of beauty and that sort of thing. And so are comic strip people. They're making an ideal pretty girl or handsome man or whatever the thing is, rocket ship. But one is thought of as important and the other isn't. But by making archetypes, I am trying to make them into icons. And if you, particularly even in sculpture where I isolate something, you know, it can be a lamp that's standing on its light rays, you know, or something like that, or a German expressionist head or something. I try to make it as cliched or as typical or whatever it is. And that's really the same thing, I think, as making it classical.
You grew up in New York. What kind of pop culture and high culture were you exposed to when you were young?
Well, when I was young was eons ago, and there was very little pop culture. You know, there was no teenager economy. There was no... You know, there were toy stores that had wooden toys. Remember those? but you wouldn't think of that as being pop.
There were movies.
There
was music.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Well, there was pop music. But if you're thinking of Nelson Eddy and Jeanette McDonald, I don't know. That's my childhood, really, but matured, of course, it got into 50s and pop music and things like that. But I don't think I was at all immersed in pop culture. That wouldn't really be, it would almost like being in France or something, you know. I mean, I used to go to the Metropolitan Museum and the Museum of Natural History and things like that. You know, there just weren't, there really wasn't the big pop culture. Maybe that's why I'm struck by it, because I see it from a distance. Because, in 1961, when I did my first pop thing, I was 38 years old, so I... But I had gone through the 50s and all of that, but I was older, you know. So,
well, mm-hmm. No, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck.
No, they were there.
They'd been around for a really long time.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
So were you familiar with them from your youth?
Did they
matter to you?
As much as they mattered to anyone. I don't think I had any special interest in it. But I would probably read comic books with Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, or maybe had toys like that. I don't know.
You know what I'm going to ask you about? The style that you paint in, that style that looks mm-hmm. like mechanical reproduction but isn't, this is a style that you appropriated from mass culture.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me at this point it's become something else. Mm-hmm. It's become mm-hmm. your style. It's become
yeah.
your personal
mm-hmm.
style.
Mm-hmm.
So painting in that style must feel really different than it did when you started. It must have really become a way to express yourself, to a very personal vocabulary for you. One that you must be very comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that's, you're explaining it very well, that because it originally had that meaning, this is printing and so forth, and I don't think that's, even though it still may mean that, it certainly doesn't reveal anything, and it's just become a way of making colors. So now, or tonalities, I use dots and diagonals and dots that graduate from thick to thin, and I mix them up in the painting with other colors, and it just became a way of working. And if I could find a way out, I would be happy to do that, you know, but the way has to mean something, I tried one group, which I like a lot, of landscapes made of brushstrokes, some of which are real brushstrokes and some are cartooned brushstrokes. And they work together in the painting, and it gives the painting a certain interesting surface, which I would have disdained a few years ago. But so I'm trying to do various things and trying to extend it, but I don't want to make it complicated or decorative. And I like the plainness of it, but it is just the way I work. And it's interesting that what would become everyman's style, is very recognizable. So it becomes a signature. I don't want to do it for that reason, but I...
No, but that's absolutely right. Mm. You see one of your paintings now, and you don't think, oh, he's copying the mass reproduction mm-hmm. style from comics and advertising. You think, oh, it's a Lichtenstein.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So how does it feel to be reunited with all your paintings at the Guggenheim Retrospective?
Oh, well, I'm thrilled at that because they did a wonderful job of putting them in and lighting and everything. And I thought it'd be very difficult to show they do seem to... to me, anyway, to look wonderful, and it's great to see paintings I haven't seen since I did them.
That's right, because you sell them, and then you don't have access to them after that.
Yeah, I mean, I may see them in a museum, or I may see a collector who has one or something, but by and large, there are many paintings I haven't seen for 25 years or something. So it's I love to see them, and it's nice that they're doing it, and... So I'm in sort of paradise and, extremely happy about the thing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The Roy Lichtenstein Retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum in New York runs through January 16th, then travels to Los Angeles and Montreal. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll hear about the search for votes in Congress for and against the North American Free Trade Agreement. Also today, Ira Glass has a special report on Taft High School in Chicago, a school that's experimenting with all sorts of reforms, creating small schools within a school. And we'll hear what the opinions are so far in the school about those changes. Mixed reviews, it seems. Also, we'll be talking about buzzwords. Not exactly slang, but the words that people who purvey services use to describe their customers, clients, patients, and passengers when there's not always a smile on their face and when the customer isn't always right.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The rock group The Breeders are a 4-year-old quartet from Dayton, Ohio, led by identical twin sisters Kim and Kelly Deal. After a few highly praised releases on small independent labels, they've just released their first major label collection. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Last Splash.
We were rich once before your head exploded. Imagine just what the Big Bang did.
If the fact that a band led by women has chosen to call itself The Breeders strikes you as a bit of unfortunate rock and roll self-loathing, all you have to do is listen to their music to understand where Kim and Kelly Deal are coming from. This is the sort of stuff that turns insults into threats at the flick of a guitar chord, that grapples with the notion of femininity in rock from a position of strength. There's nothing bitter or self-hating about these Breeders.
Behind the skies and the sweet caress.
On most Breeders songs, the lyrics are an ominous blur. Kim Deal's lead vocals reveal a strong yet lulling sound that tends to blend into Kelly's lead guitar lines. Read the words on their lyric sheet, and you come away with a series of abstract images that occasionally builds into a beautiful, nearly perfect piece of menace like this one, called Do You Love Me Now?
If I saw you now, could I look in your eyes? Do you think of me like I dream of you? Do you wish you were here like I wish I was with you? You loved me before.
On Do You Love Me Now and the song that I played at the top of this review called I Just Want to Get Along, Kim Deal takes those supplicating, conciliatory title phrases and turns their meanings inside out. The listener becomes the boyfriend to whom those words are spoken, and you get the feeling that you'd better get along and you'd better love her now because this is a woman who's not going to settle for any of your bull. The Breeders give empowerment a good name.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Breeders' new album, Last Splash. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm just looking for a way around.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the past and future of South Africa. We talk with Helen Suzman. As a member of the South African Parliament, Suzman challenged apartheid for over 30 years. And we talk with Israeli writer and peace activist Amos Oz. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.